Welcome to The Ether. Today is Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by LuArt. LuArt is the first gamified NFT platform built on the Terra network. LuArt provides a seamless minting and trading experience, all while earning you rewards just for being a user. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the community in the Discord server for the most up-to-date news and announcements regarding all the hot new NFT launches, platform upgrades, and new projects hitting the secondary marketplace. Are you ready to put your helmet on and join the movement? Find out more at luart.io. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by WeFund. WeFund is a community crowdfunding cross-chain incubator on Terra, and it's the first launchpad that implements a milestone funding release system to protect investors. All money raised for projects is deposited in Anchor Protocol, and it's refundable, and all decisions are based on community voting power. WeFund is community-focused and designed to be a user-friendly experience for both project creators and investors. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the Telegram for more information. Links are in the show notes and check them out online at WeFund.app. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, VGX Heroes, History of Money, Season 2, Episode 6, 1971 and Beyond. Let's take a listen.
All right, give us a couple minutes. Getting set up as usual. Got a good show coming. I love this stuff as we get closer to the modern times. All right, here we go. Co-host, Aldo, gotta get you up here. Mr. PP, Stallone, Loki, let's see, did I miss anybody?
No, I updated my app and now I lost my OG emojis, but what's going on, everybody? Glad to be back. Sorry I missed last week. You know, life happens, but we got an exciting topic. Looking forward to it. If you don't mind, could you hit the bottom right plus button, share the stream, share the space, get some more people in here. Some good information going to be shared tonight. We're looking forward to it.
Another new feature, I'm not sure if you could do this before, but you can now send emojis to other listeners in the room. So if anybody wants to go ahead and smack Lagartha for me, give her 21 smacks for Hero of the Week, number 21. And also because she keeps slapping me. So have a nice little fun game going on there.
Isn't that a hand clap? Like applause?
It's open to interpretation. I like to think of it as a smack.
All right. Well, we can get it kicked off here. While we're doing introduction, gives people a little bit more time to join. I'm Pepe Salon. I'm one of your co-moderators for the evening. The VGX Hero Spaces was based off an idea from one of our OG heroes that unfortunately passed away, but it was just help spread knowledge, help educate, and help new investors as well as seasoned investors make more better informed decisions and be able to make decisions on their own. We're happy to do this. This is all volunteer, not financial advice. We're not employees of Voyager. We just like the coin. But we can get it kicked off. Aldo, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing good, man. Doing good. Frankie, what's going on?
Hey, Pep, how are you?
Doing well.
Lots going on today. Lots going on.
No doubt. No doubt. Got a little rally going on. They kind of picked the spirits back up. So we did that for you guys. That was all us. Michael bought lots of bit of the orange coin to help boost spirits. So if everybody gives some hundreds for him or some claps, whatever the emojis are these days. But Floki, how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. happy to be here. I'm excited for this one. All of the charts and stuff got me excited. I couldn't help but put it together in a tweet. If you guys check out the tweet pinned at the top of this space and scroll down, you'll see all the charts that we'll eventually get to today.
Yeah, it's truly fascinating stuff because it's things you would never even think of. So it's a lot to get into. We're looking forward to it. But Obi-Wan, what's going on, my friend?
Oh, I'm happy to take a little respite from work and hang out with y'all, talk about money and crypto and socioeconomics and all sorts of fun things.
Love knowledge. Oh, what's going on, Michael?
Oh, another day in paradise. Talking to internet strangers about the history of money, and this one's a particularly fun topic, seeing all the things that have just completely fallen off a cliff since 1971. So, been looking, building up to diving into exactly what happens when that little yodel man from The Price is Right goes off the cliff.
Love it, love it. And yeah, then dang internet strangers, you meet up with one for Thanksgiving, they steal your glasses, so can't trust them. But what's going on, Sunzi?
I'm good. Long day, but a good day. So ready to get some knowledge in, and because this is definitely, you know, I don't actively seek these things out. So when it's made easy for me like this, I can't say no. So I'm excited.
All right, well, let's do it. Frankie, let's kick it off, my friend.
Well, thank you, Pep. Where do we start with the news? I guess we can start with there are finally signs that there might be a chance that there are discussions that QE might come to an end. This is after the Fed ballooned its balance sheet to $6 trillion of treasuries and mortgage-backed bonds in the past 2 years after the onset of the COVID pandemic, which will probably most definitely reappear in a few months when stocks implode and the economy slides into recession. Maybe alongside the Fed's direct purchase of stocks and equity ETFs, which include more than 580 separate operations to buy treasuries, and then about 1,200 to purchase mortgage-backed securities. This combined is larger than all three of the Fed's previous quantitative easing programs combined, helping to grow the central bank's balance sheet to an unprecedented $8.4 trillion. So seriously, though, Fed officials said they're likely to begin to shrink the balance sheet beginning as soon as this year. I think they've said this since 1971. Hint, hint. And then, you know, there's Russia. I'll let Aldo take that in a little bit. And all that fun stuff. I will say the Biden administration is trying to get Venezuela and Iran and Saudi Arabia to help, but I don't know how willing Saudi Arabia would be to help given the politics around the Iranian nuclear deal. In other news, Senator Warren is working on a big oil windfall profit tax. That'll sure to get these big oil CEOs to increase production, I guess. Then there's a rate hike. Fed said all but cemented expectations of a 25-bit rate hike next week, but events have changed a lot in the last couple of weeks that raised a faint hint that the Fed may not hike. Surprise. And then the biggest news, the crypto executive order. So after being pressured from, you know, people in the industry, such as venture capitalists and entrepreneurs, it was leaked last night that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen appeared to accidentally praise the new executive order. Took a quick look at it. Looks purposefully broad. So some of the specific executive orders call for measures to protect U.S. consumers, investors, and businesses. Kind of like the Gensler protecting us investors in the equity markets.
Protect me harder, Gary. Protect me harder.
Yeah, exactly. protect U.S. and global financial stability and mitigate systemic risk by encouraging the Financial Stability Oversight Council. It's a mouthful. I feel like that there's going to be a few billion thrown into that group. I want to be in that. Yeah, I want to be the person running that, getting some money under the table. Mitigate the illicit finance and national security risks posed by illicit use of digital assets. Yeah, I can say that anywhere from 80 to 95% of any dollar bill was used in illicit activities. You know, snorting coke, used as other things. Promote U.S. leadership in technology and economic competitiveness to reinforce U.S. leadership in the global financial system by directing the Department of Commerce to work across the U.S. This is just talk about pork in a bill, in an executive order. So someone's getting paid off here. Promote equitable access to safe and affordable financial services, okay, by affirming the critical need for safe, affordable, and accessible financial services. I don't know. Is a lot of this, what was the quote that Reagan gave? The thing that we should fear the most is when the government says, hey, I'm here to help. This seems like a lot of that. Next is support technological advances and ensure responsible development and use of digital assets by directing the U.S. government to take concrete steps to study and support technological advances and responsible development, design, and implementation of digital assets systems while prioritizing privacy, security, combating illicit exploitation, sure, and reducing negative climate impacts. The ESG people, I wonder where that's coming from. BlackRock, explore a U.S. central. Oh, here we go. This is the cherry on top. Explore a U.S. central bank digital currency. Okay, so basically, take the little rights that U.S. citizens have by making a digital currency, by placing urgency on research and development of a potential United States CBDC. Fuck you. Should issuance be deemed in the national interest? Of course it is. We can take your money if we don't like your politics. The order directs the U.S. government to assess technological infrastructure and capacity needs for a potential U.S. CBDC in a manner that protects Americans' interests. I think they mean the political class's interest. The order also encourages the Federal Reserve to continue its research, development, and assessment efforts for a U.S. CBDC, including development of a plan for a broader U.S. government action in support of their work. That seems like a lot of pork there, too. So according to the Treasury, crypto's a larger than $3 trillion market, which some 40 million Americans have already invested in. So it's a big tax revenue stream for them, is what I read there. Among other aspects of the new executive order, the administration is prepared to look at how crypto is used to get around Western sanctions. Sure. It also comes as a growing number of central banks are already issuing their own digital currencies. And then they, you know, Janet Yellen was praising Biden for signing this. This seems like, there's two sides here. There's the people who think this is a nothing burger and the people that think that, you know, this is how they slowly stick it to you without lube. So that's the big news of the day. I'll pass it over to Aldo to go overseas and talk about current events overseas.
Thanks. This is your weekly foreign affairs update. We're going to start in Europe. This week, President Zelensky of Ukraine gave an impassioned speech where he echoed Winston Churchill in pledging to fight until the end. President Zelensky called on NATO to provide a no-fly zone, which led to Poland pledging 27 MiG fighters to the effort and asked the U.S. to facilitate this via one of our air bases in Germany, to which the U.S. refused. Moving on to Russia, Well, I should say the fighting continues in Ukraine, obviously. There's been numerous reports of the use of dumb bombs and hospitals being bombed as well in Ukraine. So the situation is still dire in the Ukraine, and the two sides have not come to any agreement to essentially end the conflict. So we're still waiting for that to develop. In Russia, Russia has yet to establish a total air superiority in Ukraine due to the Ukrainian air defense system, which remains effective. Again, Russia has been reported as using dumb bombs in Ukraine. Economically, Russia is starting to feel the brunt of the sanctions as inflation has started to soar. Prices rose over 2% in the last 7 days. This is the sharpest increase since 2008 in Russia. Moving on to England. In England, due to everything that's going on in the market, or due to the Russia situation, nickel began to soar. It doubled in price. And in response, the London Metal Exchange, known as the LME, engaged in massive market rigging. One of the member clients, thought to be Chinese, essentially defaulted on a short position. And instead of letting things play out, the LME froze all the long orders and allowed the Chinese member to cover their short. And this screwed over all the investors that went long on nickel. So you're seeing TradFi manipulation on a massive scale there in England.
If I may, not only did they freeze everything, they unwound executed trades after midnight Greenwich Mean Time, after the fact. To me, this is it's GameStop on steroids. It is the most unabashed fuckery with zero shame whatsoever that I've ever seen in any public market.
Yeah, it's up there with like the LIBOR scandal where they got caught like rigging like the international like interest rates, all the major banks together. It's massive, absolutely massive. To unwind that it just shows you that there's massive amounts of corruption.
And the big players, did you see who the big banks were that were bailing out these Chinese giants?
No, Frankie.
JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, all the
very usual suspects.
What's that?
All the usual suspects.
All the highly ethical people in the bank, the industry leaders, that like to pound ESG down everyone's throats.
Why does that not surprise me? Moving on to the Middle East, the Gulf monarchies, notably Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, have been refusing to take calls from President Biden. This is due to many reasons. President Biden has been calling Saudi and the UAE to ask them to increase the global oil supply in order to stem the skyrocketing gas prices. And they have both refused to increase output. And that's due to numerous reasons. Specifically, both the UAE and Saudi Arabia are upset over the refusal of the current administration to support the two nations and their efforts in Yemen and Qatar against the Iranian-backed Houthi insurgents. They are also upset about the revisiting of the Iranian nuclear development program, which they view as a regional threat to the Gulf states. They also feel insulted by the current administration calling Saudi Arabia a quote unquote a pariah state that has little to socially offer, and Also, this administration released an intelligence report that essentially accused one of the princes, Prince Mohammed, of ordering the assassination of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but that was a journalist that was literally assassinated in a Turkish in a Saudi embassy in Istanbul, Turkey. It was a pretty outrageous story. You guys should go look it up if you're interested. But this guy basically got whacked in an embassy in pretty gruesome fashion. So the Saudis didn't take too well to be calling to being called a pariah state, and then basically accusing one of their royal family members of ordering a hit. So they're not playing nice with us right now because of that.
Don't forget good old fashioned money.
Yeah, good old fashioned. Yeah, why would we want to dump a whole bunch of oil on the market and lower our profit? Absolutely. I mean, OPEC has played this game for years, right? So let me see, what else do I have here? In Asia, India refuses to condemn Russia over the Ukraine invasion at a special Quad summit. So the Quad summit is roughly it's analogous to NATO in the East to counter China. It's essentially led by the U.S., India, Australia, and blanking on the last one, but essentially India has refused to condemn Russia at this summit that they had. The U.S. is continuing to pressure India into condemning Russia, and Washington's stance is that they're not ready to accept anything short of full support for its war drive against Russia. But India is in a precarious position because they get 53% of their military arms from Russia. And so because of the sanctions, it's literally affecting their national security. So they've seen a 53% reduction in arms purchases due to these sanctions. So they're kind of in a, you know, in a rock and a hard place right here in terms of these sanctions against Russia. So there's that. Japan was the fourth nation, I'm sorry. So it's India, Japan, Australia, and the U.S. That are the members of the Quad body. In Iran, the Iran's Revolutionary Guard launched a second satellite today. It's called the Noor-2 satellite. It achieved low Earth orbit at 310 miles above Earth. Allegedly, the U.S. dismissed it as a spinning webcam in space. That's according to the Times of India. So we're kind of downplaying that satellite launch in Iran. And one bit of European news that I left out is that Hungary will not support a ban on Russian energy imports. The Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said that essentially Russia, while it supports, while it condemns the actions of Russia in the invasion of Ukraine, they're not going to make their citizens pay for it financially. So they're going to continue to import energy, or basically oil, from Russia. So that is your weekly wrap up in international news.
Great stuff. Yeah, can we get a round of applause for that? Great stuff. But
slaps.
Yeah, whatever these emojis are, they're really killing the fun of it. but yeah, we can get it started with Michael and Obi to kind of lead us up to the topic tonight.
Yeah, before we dive into the 1971 stuff, I would just like to go around the horn. Some of these news topics, I'd love to get everybody's take on the panel on what really jumped out at them, because I think that Frank and Aldo did a tremendous job giving everybody the highlights here, but there's just so much to unpack over this past week since our last Spaces. Start, the EO is one thing, we pretty much made the case against CBDCs pretty aggressively over the last few sessions, especially including last week. But the way that they slid the CBDCs at the end of that EO fact sheet, I thought was interesting. But as far as the takeaways for me that jumped out at me looking at the EO stuff was, one, they do recognize a place for digital assets. So that kind of quells any FUD about outright forbiddance and outlying digital assets in the country. They also seem to signal a recognition that we need to be leaders in the space, which is somewhat of a reassurance. Sure, they packaged that little ESG virtue signaling bullshit in there about environmental impact, as if they were trying to signal towards proof of stake chains and giving them a little bit of a tip of the hat. But had they really been prepared to take an aggressive position against proof of work, I think they would have done so in more black and white terms. So I think that they also recognize that proof of work isn't going anywhere, and they probably just need to figure a way to spin their narrative accordingly. But Obi, I'd be curious to get your take. What's your quick reaction to the EO and what made it into it? You know, I agree that it's mostly a nothing burger and it's mostly kicking the can down the road, but there were a few things to me that they're telegraphing as far as how they're looking at this moving forward.
Yeah, they're just kind of taking the highlights of the talking points that they had to read off a sheet from their reviews that they did over the past few months, you know, last year. To me, it seems like they're wanting to just effectively take the powers that they already have and the excessive powers that they already have. And with the Patriot Act and the SWIFT system and the sanctions, and they want to make sure that everything's tilted in their favor from the looks of it. Hey, we want you guys to be successful with digital assets and have a chance at actually, you know, making money in excess of interest. However, we do want to make sure that we use this as a revenue producing opportunity and that we have the ability to shut off your money because it can be used for nefarious means. is kind of how I read it. And, you know, the way they want to partner internationally with others is basically telegraphing, hey, we really want to use this new technology to replace our outdated SWIFT system, but we need the ability to shut countries out like we're doing with Russia. It's kind of what I'm reading into this as meaning. And then, of course, as we've all been talking about, the ultimate kick to the nards, the CBDC, which I really hope that we can get some bills on the floor to try to, as Aldo would say, you know, kill that in the cradle.
Yeah, well, I think I saw earlier today, Cynthia Lummis's bill is pretty much ready for print. So I think that there's already some teasers out there of the language in that bill, if not the whole thing already. And I think that we'll probably see the whole thing by the end of the week, if we haven't already. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the censorship of international transactions, because that actually led me to the second light bulb that went off for me as Frank and Aldo were talking, was on the ETH side of the house. If anybody noticed, JP Morgan's, first of all, admission that they are basically huge stakeholders in the infrastructure behind MetaMask and Infura. And then that also tied into just what was overall a horrible week for MetaMask, because they actively caved and began censorship of transactions to Venezuelan citizens, which basically is kind of a death knell for the whole decentralized, you know, to me, there isn't a very good wallet solution, node solution, decentralization solution on, you know, at least speaking granularly on the ETH network. But it showed just how vulnerable the ETH ecosystem is to coercion. And in this case, it was coercion against MetaMask and Infura for processing Venezuelan transactions. But I'm not sure if anybody actually saw that happening earlier in the week. I didn't think that JP Morgan, you know, basically trying to build up a centralized position in the infrastructure behind the ETH network, caught nearly enough press. And that was, you know, that kind of broke via a lawsuit on behalf of Consensus shareholders that it seemed to make its way around the Bitcoin Maxi community, because it's obviously beats the same drum that they are. But otherwise, I didn't really see that get nearly the press that it should have.
No, I agree. It is big. I think if you're any kind of a blockchain right now and your primary wallet is MetaMask, you better be exploring alternatives, like actual decentralized wallets. And if anybody is using MetaMask as their primary wallet to access digital assets, we should all be looking for alternatives and demanding as politely as possible that any protocols that are being used move towards a different solution.
Yeah, I do feel somewhat validated in my thesis that ETH, although I'm not a fan of it for what some ETH maxis purport it to be, I do think that there will always be, I don't think it'll die. I'm not one of these Bitcoin maxis that thinks that ETH's going to go away, but I do think it's going to get co-opted, and I feel like the JP Morgan news was just further proof of that, because I feel like it lends itself to being co-opted by the current fiat system and the current banking system.
Yeah.
And, you know, if not internalized, at least centralized to the point of being the same good old boys club that has always, you know, pervaded the banking system, whether it be the Jekyll Island secret squirrel meetings or anything that, you know, we all suspect goes on behind closed doors.
It goes back to what I've always contended Ethereum to be, which is the, you know, the move to ETH 2 is the death knell for ETH. It will become a corporate banking chain, and the governance decided by those with the deepest pockets. And, you know, if you want to make some money off big money and have a little exposure to it and, you know, use it as an investment to flip or momentum trade, have at it. But as a network, it's completely unusable for anybody, you know, that doesn't have deep pockets. So it's really kind of becoming one of those pay to play. I really dislike it as a network. So
yeah, it reminds me of what RippleNet purports itself to be, and what XRP holders think that they own value in, and you know, that's a whole nother, that's like old news at this point, or like an old debate. But XRP holders that think that they own some of the value in RippleNet just because the token is somewhat correlated to the same name, but it the token doesn't actually serve a purpose on the network. The network itself might have value because of its ability to transact, but the token itself does not. I think ETH 2.0, or whatever the hell they switched the name to now at that last meeting, is really just trying to be this newer version of whatever Ripple thinks it is and whatever fiat actually is.
Yeah, so very, very much concerned about, you know, the underlying. There are a lot of power players at place in not only Ethereum but some other layer ones out there, and some supporting infrastructure. And you can just pay attention to the news of where's the VC money going, where's the big money going, what's Morgan Stanley and JP doing. You know, there's a who's owning the news, who's behind certain decentralized, you know, quote unquote decentralized networks. And you really kind of look at them and you're like, oh, these aren't decentralized at all. And there's a lot of those. And I think there's very few good things out there in the crypto space, like truly that fulfill the ethos of crypto. So, you know, money's already been solved by Bitcoin, and stablecoins already manage day-to-day spending and remittances, you know, short of having full-on adoption of Bitcoin, which, you know, I think that's going to take many, many, many decades to get to that point. So, you know, in the interim, they're kind of, you know, stepping stones, I would say. So any network that, or wallet or project, because they really are projects, they're not networks or protocols, anything that is, you know, remittance-based or payments-based that doesn't really have any reason to exist, especially Gen 1 blockchains, you know, I would very much question anybody who is holding any of those. Because, you know, not only have they been passed, but they're really just not necessary. So there's my rant.
No, I you're fueling the same fire that I am, because I would also argue that even the ones that should exist or maybe can make a use case to exist doesn't necessarily make the token itself have value on it. And anyone that's holding these layer ones because they think that the token as some you know, sort of gas or oil that lubricates the system and makes it go around and pays for it to transact as a utility within its own network. I'd be remiss if I didn't remind, you know, the great point that Jack Mallers made in one of his last interviews, that the single largest utility token on the planet is the U.S. dollar. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it implies that it's going to retain any kind of value or spending power going into the future. So the fact that a native token has utility for the fuel of a network is kind of a upside down argument, because it doesn't necessarily imply value, and it certainly doesn't translate to the passage of that value into the future.
It depends on how valuable the network is and what's being built on the network and how that can be offloaded for a real world purpose. If it's a network that's a closed loop, closed ended fund type solution, layer one, that's not interoperable, that doesn't really kind of solve a business need or have a technological moat, which very few do, then I would agree with that. But there, you know, there's a few exceptions.
Yep. Another fun, just quick point on the nickel argument. You know, I made my point about the market fuckery and the manipulation involved and the corruption, but it's pretty ironic right now that an actual physical coin nickel in your pocket right now has a melt value of 9 cents. So just another random stat from the upside down freaking bizarro clown world that we live in right now.
The money's off the rails, the corruption's off the rails, the governments are too big, and everything's kind of coming up, you know, it's all coming to a head, right?
But hey, at least COVID went away, right? Anyway, Aldo, I was curious to get your take on this whole Russia disconnecting from the global internet on March 11th thing. I know that you are a linguist and check your news sources from around the globe. I've only seen the American take on it, and at this point, I just assume that everybody's got their own flavor of propaganda. But What's your read on the situation of Russia kind of North Koreaizing and disconnecting from the global internet?
So I haven't checked into it too much. I know that they're off of Facebook, Instagram, and most of the social sites. Are they proposing an intranet, like a Chinese style, absolutely, like an intranet?
Yep, they're proposing a full blown disconnect.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. You know, if you look at historically what the Soviet Union did, I mean, this is why they were so effective in, you know, countering propaganda and you know, ideological subversion from the West. Is, you know, back in the day, you know, newspapers or articles that were written that had, you know, subversive elements in them, they would just never make it to market. Like, you know, the KGB would literally get up like in the morning and take them out of the news racks and throw them away. So like that's par for the course. And it doesn't surprise me that, that they would do that. And, you know, and what's that going to, you know, what's going to be the effects of that in Russia? I mean, obviously you're going to have a completely, isolated and walled kingdom of information that's just going to reinforce, you know, Russian narratives. And, you know, that's going to not be good for the Russian citizenry. It's not going to be good for the rest of the world, because then, you know, it's going to lead to something where, akin to North Korea or China, where, you know, people don't have access to outside information and opinions, and they can't get a well-rounded you know, source of information to form, you know, like I said, a well-rounded opinion. So that would be my take on it. One, it's not shocking. Two, historically, that, you know, they've done it in the past, so they have a propensity for it. And yeah, so that would be my take.
Thanks. Well, Pepe, I'll pass it back over to you. I appreciate you letting me derail current affairs there for a minute, but there's just so much to unpack over this past week that I feel like we could start to do spaces just on current affairs in and of itself. So I appreciate Frank and Aldo doing the deep dive on both domestic and foreign current affairs lately. They've been so relevant to the space and everything that we're talking about here. So I appreciate everybody putting in the time.
Yeah, no doubt. That was great. And I'll, just like everybody, I'm up here learning
new stuff every week. So with that, I think it's a great segue to pass it over to Michael and Obi for a little lead up to tonight's topic.
All right, Obi. So I'm gonna defer over to you. I know that you're super passionate about your Fed coupons, and I thought you killed it last week, bringing us up through Bretton Woods and up to 1971, and essentially leaving us in a state of, you know, partially feigned, somewhat redeemable paper covered in dead presidents that may or may not actually get you gold at some point in the future. But 1971, that all kind of went off the rails. So if I could kick it to you to just kind of set the stage for us for the couple of years leading up to 71 and then the Band-Aid that got ripped off and pretty much the catalyst for much of the rest of what we're going to talk about tonight.
Yeah, I'll just do a brief recap. So last week we covered, you know, North American currency and the beginning of fiat. And one of the more significant things that happened is in 1913, the Federal Reserve was formed, and there used to be two notes that we used to treat as Fed coupons. One was a literal Fed coupon, which is a Federal Reserve note minted by the Fed. And we talked about, Aldo gave a breakdown as well on, you know, the difference between what used to be a Treasury note from the United States Treasury versus a Federal Reserve note. So the Treasury note, meaning it came out of the profit and loss of the actual Treasury Department of the United States government. And everything up until 1970 was redeemable for gold. Now in 1971, we were just getting out of Vietnam. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world. The baby boomer children were coming of age to enter the workforce, the largest population boom that the world has ever seen, entering the workforce at once. Now, this was good in terms of being able to produce a lot of goods, but because of the amount of people fighting for the same jobs, labor and wages became cheaper. Economies after the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1947, I believe it was, after World War II, established the United States Fed coupons as the gold standard, not the gold standard, but the global reserve, because they were redeemable for gold. Well, these countries, as they were rebuilding on the backs of money that we provided in the Marshall Plan, they started to produce things and put their economies to work. And that, along with our massive expenses and fighting a war in Vietnam and Korea, you know, after Bretton Woods, started depleting the gold reserves of the United States. And it came to a head in 1971, where our own economy, after being, you know, our gold reserves being depleted and wages, you know, not being able to compete with production because of the boomers entering the workforce, you started to see things fracture. And that fracture happened in the form of high inflation and, you know, more people entering the workforce than there are jobs for means unemployment. And Nixon saw this and met with some of his, Treasury secretaries, Undersecretary for Monetary Affairs, the chairman of the Fed, and said, hey, you know, two note system back, you know, reserving to gold with our current Fed coupons now for gold and the start of true fiat currency, which is by decree, not backed by anything. And they put this is a big thing that doesn't get talked about as much when Nixon took the world off the gold standard, is they did a 90-day freeze on wages and prices to counter inflation. And that's the first time the government enacted the wage and price controls on the American population since World War II. And so there's some price fixing. And this measure was supposed to be temporary, right? All of this stuff was supposed to be temporary. He said that in his speech. And they also imposed a 10% surcharge on American products so we wouldn't be disadvantaged in the fluctuation of goods with the exchange rate. As you can imagine, a lot of the world was still wanting to redeem their Treasury notes and Federal Reserve notes for gold. And you know, that would cause, that would put pressure, further pressure on our currency. So they also had to put the import surcharge into place. So the United States went off the treasury or the gold standard in 1971. A few countries followed, and the whole world was off by 1973. And since then, we have experienced a large divergence in the valuation of goods and services to money. And that is what this week's topic will be about.
Great stuff. Great stuff. Yeah. Michael, you want to kind of segue from there?
Yeah. So if anybody hasn't already seen it, Floki's tweet is pinned to the spaces. So there's a fantastic website called WTFHappenedIn1971.com that was kind of the inspiration and a lot of the source material for what we plan to share tonight. And it's basically just a collection of charts that show the changes over time. And most of them have an inflection point at 1971, ironically enough. And a few of them are fairly obvious. You know, they're pretty on the nose. They're intuitive when you get into like money supply and CPI and inflation and things like that. But some of them really make you have to explore the difference between causation and correlation. And I think that's what we kind of intend to do tonight here, as far as especially the ones that have socioeconomic impact. So Floki, would you like to kind of drive? I know that you organize the charts in the order, so I can pretty much take us through your tweets in order, but if you want to step in for a moment and just kind of lead, I'd be happy to defer to you as well.
Yeah, I figured I just wanted to set something up for you guys and the audience to easily follow along visually, because it's really difficult to imagine the impact in your head. The charts really do help. And I probably should have put the website somewhere in that tweet, but I'll do that. I'll do that after. So yeah, if you guys go to the tweet that I set up earlier, try to do something a little intriguing with the whole point break, breaking point, Nixon thing. I hope you enjoyed that. Today, I was walking the dog and listening to all of these different YouTube videos on the topic to try to familiarize myself. And that's the first tweet that you'll see. Well, technically the second one. I wouldn't do this now, but down the line, I recommend checking these out. The first one, very cartoony, very deep dive of the Federal Reserve and you know, how it went from a good idea to, you know, abusive power, very detailed in terms of a narrative. The second video is the raw graphs. That one, it's a really smart guy going through all of these graphs that we're showing here at another layer of detail. So also very good. And the third one is just a good summary. It's kind of a blend between both of them. So now we're in the third tweet, 3 of 22, where I start listing all of these graphs, and I figure we will go through them one at a time. And you know, if you guys, as we pull these up, have thoughts or want to discuss, I think it was really good that we started discussing the current events and foreign affairs as well, not just stating them. And a lot of these are really thought-provoking. So you know, TL top left, TR top right. We're going to go from top left to bottom right. So what's the first one that I'm going to kick off to you guys? It's the growth in productivity and hourly compensation since 1948. So go ahead and click that first one. And, you know, Michael, Obi, panel, you got all you smart guys. I'll let you talk about it. So what does this graph say?
So the first thing that jumps out to me on this one, and thanks for putting all the work in to catalog and organize this, Floki. I think it'll help for a lot of people to follow along. But prior to 1971, you had 90.84% as your point in the graph where everything deviated. As far as the growth in productivity and hourly compensation, you had and since then, from that point to 2017, compensation is up 115%, while productivity is up 246%. And to me, what this screams is the invention of this standard of the 40-hour work week, which really is not standard. It's known now and accepted as normalcy. But as far as the addition of work and the expectation that X amount of work needs to be completed, X amount of your time needs to be completed without any kind of commensurate compensation, is a fairly novel concept. You know, there was never this concept in past history. So we'll see later on too that this also plays into gender roles and, you know, single income households versus two income households. But what this kind of screams out to me is that post 1971, it necessitated this expectation of a set fixed amount of work that you're going to do. And it just continued to increase from there. And, you know, now half the people that are salaried for a 40-hour work week have to actually work 60 hours to get their job done, or you're working on an hourly wage. And at that point, most hourly wage workers, unless you're, you know, like a white collar hourly wage worker in the context of like lawyers and consultants and things like that, that are making absurd amounts of money per hour. But your typical, when you think of an hourly wage worker, is basically in that feedback loop of being incentivized to have high time preference because you've got to work to make money, to spend money, and you can never get out of that loop. You can never build any kind of savings or assets or invest in any way, shape, or form. But to me, this first chart is all about creating that basis for a 40-hour work week and the expectation that we can just continue to pile on the employee layer of the citizenry without actually having to make the compensation commensurate with it. Because you'll see later on, too, that actual income earners compared to, you know, generational wealth holders and people with investment income, that disparity has just gotten insane since 1971.
And I wanted to add just a little bit to that, because that's my favorite chart, is that, you know, if you look at the percent of production increase relative to the wage increase, and this is before all the money, 60, you know, about since this chart ends, there's about the increase in money's gone up like 60%. So it's even worse. But if you just kind of do the math, the 200%+ increase in production versus the only 100 and change increase in salary, that means that if we were kind of on the gold standard, we'd all be making about 2.5 to 3 times more than we currently are. So kind of imagine what your life would be if your salary was more tied to the output and you were making 2.5 to 3 times what you currently are. Just wanted to add that.
Maybe you'd only be working 20 to 30 hours a week.
Right. And it brings into to context the concept of like time billionaires and the fact that your only true finite resource in your life is time. And this expectation that a certain amount of it needs to be committed to work, you know, it eliminates the ability to just be content at a certain point or work until you're content. And it's that whole juxtaposition of live to work versus work to live. But Ross, I see you've got a hand raised, so let's kick it over to you.
Y'all are plucking my heartstrings right now because this is kind of one of my areas of major interest, being an IO psychologist, because so much of it is based upon why we work and how we incentivize individuals to continue working. You know, ideally, we want to set up situations that are beneficial for both the employee and the organization, but usually there's going to be some type of disparate outcome. And usually, more often than not, unfortunately, it's going to be the organization that wins out. Now, one of the things that isn't captured in what the fuck happened in 1971, but I thought was also still important to kind of couch in some of this discussion, is a lot of the policies were playing out. No, all the policies didn't just drop in 1971. A lot of that policy agenda played out over the subsequent, you know, 5, 6 so years in particular. One of the things that really caught my eye is the shift in the American workforce away from pensions to 401ks. Now, I'm not saying that pensions are, you know, perfect. There is no investment vehicle that is 100% foolproof and without pitfalls. But at the time, organizations were incentivized to continue trying to, you know, make sure the workers had living wages and could continue to build that actual organizational loyalty. Well, with 1974 and the transition to 401ks, next thing you know, you have all this responsibility that was originally on the organization now shifted to the employee. So with the shift from the gold standard, now you have all the retirement and you know, life planning now being shifted to the employee. And it's basically a perfect storm to incentivize organizations to cut costs at the expense of workers, because they essentially now have them on the hook as wage slaves. I know it's kind of a grim outlook, but I think that's why a lot of us, you know, try to invest, is because, as Michael alluded to, that the most valuable resource we have is time. And regardless of whether or not you're, you know, looking to retire early, I think most of us at the end of the day want that financial independence so that the work that we do provide, that we do produce, is on our time and for, you know, our own purposes, as opposed to an organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we have much of a choice unless you're satisfied struggling, but to invest. You have to invest. You know, it should be, and this was something that I pulled from one of the videos, is that you should be able to be an expert in your field to the fullest extent. And that's how you give back to, you know, the community and society. But now we have to spend part of our time, half of our time, as investors as well, because that's the only way to keep up at this point, because of the decoupling of gold. It's crazy.
Yeah, no doubt. Nothing else on that. We can just keep it moving on to the next chart.
I was going to throw in there real quick, as we are coming up on the hour, for anyone new who is joining us, if you could do us a favor and hit that bottom right tweet button, so we can share it and hopefully others will pop in and join us.
Oh, and while we're in intermission here, doing some administrative stuff, shout out to Crypto Airborne, who is also streaming this right now on his channel. So if you're wanting to follow along with the pictures and charts that way, he'll be pulling up the charts as we talk about them. So save yourself a couple of thumb clicks, and you could throw around some emojis still, as opposed to, you know, digging through a tweet on Spaces if you happen to be by a computer and have your phone. So something to think about. The next chart, the top right, the TR, you know, real GDP, real wages, and trade policies in the U.S. What do you guys think?
So I'll just take the first bite of the apple. To me, it's just further validation of what we just saw. You see real median weekly earnings of full-time workers and just flatline and stagnate. Their earning potential, their ability to keep up with pace of GDP is completely, you know, cut out at the knees, while real GDP continues to go up per capita. But who does the benefit go to? Certainly not the actual folks whose blood, sweat, and tears is actually doing the work. So you just see this profiting off of the working class.
So I need to set up a link for you guys to see Crypto Airborne's, because it's only through our Discord, I believe. I'm going to try and get that set up. But my thoughts around this graph, Michael, is just how sad that red line is. It's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I mean, go ahead, Aldo.
Yeah. So what it's displaying is that essentially people are working more, producing more, they're producing more widgets, and they're getting paid less. They're literally getting paid less, and the value of the dollar is being debased. So, and with, I mean, the further along you go, and after this divergence of, like, you know, 1971, then you see that divergence increase. Yet, in both directions, right? Real GDP continues to increase. It's almost like it's almost a reverse mirror image if you look at the green line and the red line. And so what's happening is, you know, people are working the same amount of hours. Okay, the currency is getting defaced. Also, technology is increasing, methodology is increasing. Like, you know, efficiency is increasing with the exponential growth in technology, which we know through Moore's law. So people are just producing more widgets for, you know, the national GDP, the economy.
Oh, and, Aldo, you're going to love this. You're going to love this. Okay, so when I conduct job analyses, I'm breaking down random jobs that I've been assigned to study. I'm breaking them down on the basis of competencies and the knowledge, skills, abilities, and other characteristics necessary to perform the work duties and tasks associated with that job. Now, when I have to deal with job audits and I'm doing, you know, reviews of salary schedules and stuff like that, there's going to be situations where I have employees that, you know, claim that they're working out of class and situations like that. And one of the issues that commonly comes up is the sheer volume of their work. Now, it's one thing if we're talking about a job that, you know, they deal with a budget of 100,000 versus, you know, 10 million. Well, obviously the job where they deal with a $10 million budget is probably going to be, you know, a much larger scope and would be compensated accordingly. But for probably 80% of the jobs that I study, the actual volume of the workload has no impact on their compensation. As long as it's still the same knowledge, skills, abilities, and other characteristics to perform the same duties and tasks associated with that particular job class. So that just kind of feeds once again into the narrative that, you know, at the end of the day, yes, we are working and producing a much higher volume for the same level of pay. Those employees typically do not get regraded because of just the sheer volume of the work that they deal with.
Yeah, precisely. And yeah, I mean, you're seeing it right now. I mean, and you don't need to look at like a graph necessarily to understand this. I mean, just think anecdotally, you know, like back in the 80s, you could have, stay-at-home mom and, you know, a one house, a single household income could provide for two cars. I mean, middle class, essentially. And, you know, maybe that 1 week vacation a year. You know, I don't really think that's, I don't know anyone in the middle class or lower middle class that's able to afford that these days, you know? So, yeah, but the graphs are excellent displays, or tools to help people visualize this divergence, this radical divergence that's taken place over the past 40, 50, so years. And, yeah, it's just, you know, it's coming to a head now. So,
all right, I think I got this set up now for you guys for your convenience. If you go to that pin, the new pin tweet, you'll have the link to Airborne's stream, so you could view the graphs as we talk about them, and you could still emoji and raise your hand to contribute to the conversation.
Thank you, my friend.
So, Foggy, if you're good with that, I'm going to take us into the next chart, because to me, the next thing that speaks to me really is it kind of bridges the chart that we were on right now and the next one, which would be income gains widely shared in early post-war decades, but not since then. And it breaks it down into the percentile. So you see that the 95th percentile, you know, a la the folks that actually had either generational wealth or the ability to have surplus income to invest and maintain par with increases everywhere else, really didn't have a problem. You know, they more than doubled along the way, or they close to doubled along the way, and at this point they've more than doubled in the years since. But you see that lowest quintile, you know, you see the median and then that lowest quintile that's just completely fallen off a cliff and stagnated since 1971, and they maintain 100% parity with where they were. And to me, this just kind of resonates with that very first lesson that we did in this new season of these spaces, where we talked about time preference and the things that either high or low time preference enable you to do and enable you to evolve to, or force you to do and force you to regress to. And we talked about the fisherman, right? So we talked about the fisherman who every day wakes up, goes to fish, catches enough fish to feed his family, and then does that lather, rinse, repeat until the end of time. And that gentleman never gets ahead compared to the second fisherman who invests 10 or 15% of his time each day to building a better system, building a net or building a boat, and then building a fleet of boats, and then accelerating that while also then fishing for the remainder of his day and investing into the future to try to transport that wealth into the future. And this, to me, just shows that that lowest quintile is basically being forced to be that first fisherman. Because if you cannot ever actually outpace par, you are forced into this system where you have to just stagnate. You're essentially turning the land of opportunity into this feudal caste system where you do not have the means to elevate yourself out of the class in which you're born, if you're born into that lowest quintile. You know, if you have the luxury of being born into that red line, then good for you. God bless. Hopefully you're philanthropic. But if you're born into that lowest quintile, the monetary system that you were born into, in a lot of cases, has taken the opportunity for you to escape that and put a glass ceiling on you. And then to me, the last chart, and particularly this one that breaks it down based on socioeconomic quintiles, is the most telling.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm kind of fearful that it's always going to be the new standard now, that you're going to have to do investments of some sort to keep up with things, so to speak. So, you know, standardizing that process to the lower percentile is probably the most important thing, which is, you know, shameless Voyager plug, you know, and empowering people to do that easily. You know, so at least they're on that trajectory upwards in investment, as opposed to just being completely stagnant and just not knowing what to do. You know, we have to bring the baseline up in investment strategy. Otherwise, yeah, people will be stagnant. Maybe not as severely as it needs to be now, but I think it'll always be there, that need to invest.
It begs the question of who the fuck is Gary Gensler protecting? Because right. Sure as shit isn't that lowest quintile that needs to get ahead. He's right. Protecting that red line and the ability to maintain that red line.
He's protecting us from us, damn it. But yeah, the next chart, yeah, it goes hand in hand and kind of further proves the point of just how significantly this has helped the top 1%. But real quick, Harry, thanks for hopping up here. You got a question or anything you want to add, my friend? All right, well, we can keep it rolling. So, yeah, no, looking at the next chart, the bottom right one on the first.
Income growth.
Yeah, income growth. I mean, it's pretty mind-boggling to see how much or how one-sided the transition has been.
So I believe in that bottom right one, income growth, Major, you had it. I'm watching the stream. Was that one. You could see let me pull it up as well on Twitter. You could see things really start to take off in the mid 80s and the 1990s, and guess what that was? That was the stock market. So where do you think the 1% with all that extra money decided to put their money? Stock market. So that's what that is.
Yeah, that was a whole movement. That was they were called the Yuppies back in the day, if anyone remembers that. Actually, the Yuppies, and yeah, that was a thing until when was the stock market crash? Was it like 87?
I was gonna say 86, 87.
Yeah.
Young urban professionals.
Yep, internet plus stock market means 1% go boom, even more 1%.
Yeah, I'm curious where that chart would be if it was updated to 2020.
Yeah, that's the hilarious thing about all these charts is that these charts were already pretty pathetic enough. And then if you actually updated them post-COVID with the fact that, you know, I think it was 40% of the monetary supply was printed within 18 months. I saw a recent statistic, though, that actually included the entire pandemic where I don't know if it was in comparison to M1 or M2, but it was upwards of like 80% of money in circulation printed since the beginning of the pandemic. It's absolutely absurd. The type of like Weimar insanity numbers that we're talking about right now.
And isn't there another $1.5 trillion proposed right now currently?
Well, isn't that the Keynesian way? Never found a problem you couldn't spend your way out of? Just make sure you die before the bill comes?
That's it. And just blame inflation on whatever problem comes up.
Trillions and trillions and trillions. Moving on, I think, to the next graph, right? Which is, now we're in a new tweet here. Tweet number 4. Gross domestic income. Compensation of employees, paid and salary. And you can see it's pretty tragic.
Sorry, it's getting too much of a pain to do it on my phone. I'm waiting for Airborne. There we go.
Yeah, I think these are pretty much telling the same story, but in the inverse. So it's the same representation. Your wages obviously have not maintained par. And if you don't see the catalyst all kind of aligning at that 1971 date, then I don't know what the hell you're looking at. Because there's some of these, when we get into the later ones, that may be, you know, correlated but not caused. But some of these in the front are just so on the nose. You know, Ross, I'd be curious to get your take, being the most academic of the bunch, as to how these kind of fall between causation and correlation. But to me, some of these first ones are impossible to even make the case that it's just correlated and not caused.
Everything's going to be a post hoc analysis of economic data, you know, so it's, you know, there's definitely enough of these consistent trends and different data sets that they seem to all be telling the same story. So even though it wasn't like necessarily an experimental design, that doesn't mean that, you know, an abundance of support can be pretty hard to refute nonetheless.
Quick point I do want to add on that. Nixon did say the transition was temporary, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as temporary as the income tax, as Obi said.
Yeah, some charts are less thought-provoking and more just sad. Like, this one's just a really straightforward, sad one. Any other thoughts, or should we move on to the next one? And I figured we should wait to bring up the topic till Airborne updates. So we're now on the top right corner graph, share of total before tax income flowing to the highest income households. Tweet 4, picture from the top right.
So this, to me, is another one of those charts that, you know, targets those evil 1%ers that we hear about. And what strikes me is that the same, oh boy, how do I do this without getting political? Maybe let me preface this by saying that I think all politicians on both sides of the spectrum are completely full of shit. So if you're on the left and you hate me because I say something from the right, let's get over it. And if you're on the right and you hate me because I say something that doesn't necessarily jive with what you like, let's get over that too. The folks that vilify the 1% will do anything except for admit that the 1% may have had more gunpowder to play the game with, but the game was created by those same assholes in Washington, D.C. There wouldn't be a game to be played had there not been this just proclivity to play games with this fiat experiment since 1971 and to do backdoor secret meetings on Jekyll Island in 1913. So those, maybe 1913, the capitalists and the bankers had a bit more of a hand from the private side of things, but the politicians are ultimately where the buck stops as far as creating these systems that ultimately get gamed by the people that are the most inclined to game them. But I think that much of what we see in terms of class warfare is manipulation, diversion, and subversion of a population that's more than happy to digest such content and be subverted. But at the end of the day, look at what the climate is politically that creates this environment where the top 1% can continue to thrive. And then look at the returns on investment that these same civil servants that we elect to D.C. managed to get for their own personal portfolios.
Well, I mean, and to add insult to injury, Michael, they're actually impervious to law. So to reference back to your aristocracy or feudalism or neo-feudalistic comment that you made earlier, that's it. It's neo-feudalism. That's literally what we're experiencing. you know, when congressmen can literally vote on a law that makes them impervious to insider trading, and then they want to throw old Martha Stewart in jail or prison or whatever, you know, there's a problem. When senators are worth, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars, and when they're elected, and then they're, you know, when they retire, they're worth, you know, millions and tens of millions of dollars because of the access to information they have, and because they all got together and voted that it's not insider trading when they do it, which is on record. You can look that up, by the way. You cease to have a functioning a constitutional republic. You have an aristocracy. You have feudalism. Yeah, so that's what it is. And we're trying to fight our way out of it through digital assets. I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, so I'd say we're probably good to move on to the next chart. Keep it moving.
So we are now on the bottom left, tweet 4, income share of the top 1% relative to the bottom 90%.
More of those evil 1%ers.
Yeah, I was about to say that it's a similar graph to the previous, so we can go ahead and move on, I would say.
Yeah, I'd say so. But yeah. You could see the red arrow there pointing to the bottom. Where was the bottom? 1971.
Yep, so we can move on to the fourth page, bottom right, average black income as percentage of average white income.
Okay, I wanted to chime in on this one first. I did want to point out, I think it's important to keep in mind the Civil Rights Act was 1964, and that definitely impacted employment practices in regards to how previously discriminated groups were selected and or promoted. Once again, this is kind of like my wheelhouse. And it is interesting to see that the compensation kind of tops out in that 70 to 80% range relative to white counterparts. What's interesting about that is that when I'm designing a test for potential selection and promotion of employees, when we have to ensure that we're abiding by employment laws, we have to be concerned about something called adverse impact. And adverse impact essentially means that when we develop a test, it cannot unfairly discriminate against a protected group, which includes things like sex and race. And what is that ratio? 4/5, 80%. So that was just kind of like a unique parallel that just kind of really jumped out at me when I saw this graph in particular.
I think that's good context to add to the graph. I'm gonna be perfectly honest on this one. This one, as far as the potentially more controversial charts on the site, is not the one that speaks to me. I think we'll get to that a little bit later when it comes into some of the breakdown of the family system and things like that. But I just didn't want to seem like glossing over this because we're a panel of white males is us being too afraid to tackle this issue head on. I'm not at all afraid of that. I don't think any one of us is going to get canceled for having an opinion on the topic of race. I wish we did have a more diverse panel up here, but I think that this particular chart is not necessarily the most indicative of the story that it's trying to tell. I think that later on you'll see that there are some aspects that kind of permeate across all races and just show the disproportionate effect on some of the socioeconomic groups and diversity groups that were maybe starting from an inferior position to begin with, as far as their how tall their chip stack was when the game got rigged on them. So I think that we've got some better charts on the topic a bit later on.
Yeah, I agree with that as well.
Let's keep it rolling. We are now on to tweet 5, top left corner, which is real GDP per capita and median male/female income. Kind of the more of the same, except it's just a little more detailed.
Yeah, I don't have much to add on this one, honestly.
Yeah, to me, I think we'll get to the more interesting male-female stuff later. Obi, if you've got something, go for it. But to me, the more interesting male-female is the fact that you had to have, you know, a working couple. You needed two working incomes in a household in order to survive. And to me, that's the more interesting aspect of the male-female dynamic. So if somebody's got something specifically on this chart, go for it.
Yeah, I'm going to throw out something on this one because this shows real GDP per capita, but it shows median income. So it's more the middle than what an average would be, which would be skewed by the highs and lows, right? But look at the female one on the bottom.
Yep.
And see how much closer the blue and red lines are together. They were close before 1971, and they're close post-1971. So what this tells me, according to the male chart above, where there's a little bit more divergence, but you know, I think that something I kind of get from looking at this bottom one is that females probably aren't getting put into leadership positions or company ownership positions that would kind of make the chart move a little bit more divergent, like the male counterparts. So a lot of lower wage jobs or not in positions of power, and you don't get that skew, like an average would skew the number, a median is a little bit fairer representation, but you know, using a median, you get more of kind of what the middle is. And yeah, that points out to me that it is quite askew. Hope I got the point across.
The gender wealth gap, basically.
The gender, well, it's not only the gender wealth gap, it is the gender wealth gap in executive C-level suite positions.
Yes, the corporate.
In particular, right, the highest paying jobs. Yeah.
And what's interesting is if you broke down the job of a homemaker or a housewife, if you will, if they actually did the full suite of responsibilities, you know, childcare, planning, budgeting, cleaning, laundry, cooking, all that. Today, as of, I think, like 2019, 2020, usually they replicate this study every 10 years or so. But most recently, it listed what the average annual income should be for that person was over $150,000.
Yeah, Ross, I've seen those. And it's absolutely, absolutely true. I mean, think about if you have a maid. Like, how much do you pay her, like, to come, or whoever, male or female, doesn't matter, to come clean your place? Then think about everything else that being a stay-at-home mom, like, requires. Like, you'd be paying through the roof for all of those.
Yeah, and I'll throw in just the cost of daycares and babysitters, everything like that. That alone, the cost of that.
Precisely.
My wife shared something interesting with me a moment ago. There's an article recently that said that the number of CEOs with the name first name John, just the CEOs with the first name John, outnumbers the number of women CEOs. That's pretty stark.
Wow. Yeah, that's a crazy one.
I'll tweet it.
Yeah, that's a new one for me. But I think the next chart does kind of a better job kind of illustrating, you know, dual household working and stuff. You want to move on to that one?
Yeah, absolutely. To me, this is where it started to get interesting because I'm not usually the social guy. I'm usually the more analytical, just numbers guy. But to me, this starts to show the socioeconomic narrative since 1971 that I don't think that I would have just intuitively grasped without having something like this website to just put it in your face and spell it out. And this may be where we start to delve into the divergence between causation and correlation, but we can debate that. But you see here this impetus where all of a sudden we go from the gender roles in the traditional sense, not in that I'm saying that they're right or wrong, but in they were more traditional throughout history, perhaps, to this two-party working household, you know, change of the family dynamic, change of the household dynamic. You went from a period in time where the gender roles were almost celebrated, and obviously probably more so celebrated by the gender that benefited from them. But now you went into this beginning of both spouses working and the impact that that has on the household and the child rearing and education and morals and standards and the social direction of a culture. And to me, that much of that has accelerated exponentially since roughly that same period of time. To me, I think that culturally, gender roles and the family unit stagnated for a drastic period of history. And then all of a sudden, I think in the time that, you know, I think based on my understanding of the average age of most of the participants in this kind of group, most of the time that we've been alive has been a very accelerated pace at which this subject matter is changing and what is normal, quote unquote, as if there is such a thing, or acceptable or taboo, or that conversation has accelerated at such a pace that has only become even more of a blistering pace over, I think, the last 5-10 years. But it's interesting to see some of this start to tie into economic catalysts more so than political ones, more so than ideological ones. And I'd be curious to kind of pinpoint exactly how the economic trigger results in what the result is and what the direction is culturally. But I'm curious to see others' thoughts on it as well.
I mean, driven by necessity, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would say I would agree with that. The financial necessity, sure. But there, I would also say, you know, starting in the 60s and 70s, I mean, you had a cultural movement that was taking place. I mean, you had the Vietnam War. You had people questioning authority. You had a completely different counterculture that was bucking the traditional system. You know, obviously the hippie movement and the beatnik movement. Those were cultural factors that were taking place, I think, in tandem with these later economic trends as well. So I think I think there's a cultural aspect that shouldn't be overlooked as well, where people were largely distrustful of the government, especially over Vietnam. I mean, you have to realize everything that was happening in the 60s. I mean, you had the assassination of, you know, on television of President John F. Kennedy, like in live, you know, IRL. Dr. King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. You know, people were really
they wanted to close the Fed.
Oh, Obi, I threw you a layup there. No, but so the point is that society was changing culturally. So then you get to the 70s with Nixon. I mean, think about Watergate. You know, think about the distrust that the people had in government after Watergate broke. I mean, that's huge. I mean, when the edifices of society are eroded in terms of trust to that degree, people, go to different countercultures and stuff. And so I think that played into some of this cultural stuff. I mean, you had the free love movement, obviously, like I mentioned with the hippies. So that was already taking place. And then I think you have the women's lib movement that took place as well. So that was a cultural phenomenon. And then when you tack on the actual, financial and economic impact of these policies that were undertaken, I think it's a perfect storm and a perfect catalyst for radical social, change and restructuring of the landscape, the social landscape of the nation.
Let me talk about that women's, since be the resident feminist on the panel. My wife wanted me to point out that there was in 1970, in the early 1970s, there was also the, did you know that women weren't allowed to have bank accounts without their husband's name attached to them? And then in the 1970s, one thing that Ruth Bader Ginsburg kind of brought forth and or was instrumental in kind of driving was the Equal Credit Opportunity Act of 1974, which ended the discrimination on opening bank accounts. And that applied to not only women, but race, color, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, all that kind of stuff. So, and it wasn't even adopted even overseas in the UK until 1975. So, I mean, even just access to banking and being able to own, you know, quote unquote, you know, hold your own money was until after we went to a fiat system, wasn't even accessible to women. So there's a certain type of oppression that happens there as well. And that's another contributing factor to these socioeconomic slides. So a very, very important piece I don't think we should gloss over.
Yeah. Wanted to add to it. Yeah, we can get I'm going to butcher this. I'm just going to say, Peter, what's going on, my friend? You got a question or anything you want to add?
No, just more like a comment, I guess. I think a lot of it is the breaking up of the family unit is kind of like programmed into the government now, because I think, I don't know if it was a long con or what, but I feel like a lot of it is to break up the family unit and make people more reliable on some of these social programs to keep kind of the dependence on the government and the reliance on votes. So again, not sure if it's like it was intended consequences from back then, but it sure does seem like a really long-term plan of, you know, because I feel like a lot of the policies that they even create nowadays are almost, you know, anti-family oriented. Because they want everyone divided into their own little subgroups. I don't know, just a comment based on what you guys were talking about.
Yeah, appreciate you coming up here and sharing. Yeah, definitely agree with, and how, like, everybody's kind of taught, like, work, kind of, I mean, you can even see with the birth rates down, like, it's just all about work more and all about productivity and career focused. But Marty, I see you hopped up here as well. You got anything to share, add, anything like that?
Sure. Just, you know, having kind of lived through the 60s and 70s as a boomer on, you know, in the 70s, I was a teen going into 20s. And I remember the dislocation of inflation. So inflation hadn't really been around too much. And then in 1972, you basically had this pop to 12%, and it got up to 14.5% by 1980. And that was something that, you know, nobody had experienced in the United States who was alive, okay? And there was dislocation in lots of different ways. And one of the dislocations was, you know, the kind of the single, you know, adult, you know, man, you know, going to work, having the little woman stay home with the kids or whatever else, that came under dramatic pressure in that period of time. It's like most of the women I knew who were stay-at-home moms, you know, basically in the 60s and the early 70s, ended up having to like go to work like part-time, even to full-time. Just to deal with this incredible inflation that was going on. It was a very interesting financial social dislocation. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out.
Yeah, appreciate you hopping up here and sharing that into the space.
Yeah, man, yeah. Appreciate it.
I think this is a great topic, too, to lend itself to more folks coming up, too. So if you've got an interest, please request the mic. I mean, we're only 10 white males deep at this point talking about race, diversity, and gender equality. So maybe we could get somebody to offer some other perspective. But I think we're doing our best to toe the line here of just being analytical about this. I don't think that we're really trying to inject a bias, but I do think that there is an incredible amount of overlap between the trajectory that some of these things have taken since that point in history. And I do appreciate, Marty, that perspective from somebody that actually went through it, because I don't think anybody on our panel currently actually did. So much appreciated.
Absolutely. We can kind of more focus on like the charts we want to make sure to hit on, because we are kind of going through a lot of time. So,
you know, I don't know, maybe we could just take our time and go through it. And when we stop and we'll pick it up. We kind of leave it up to the panel. I think there's a lot of really interesting stuff here. And Marty, maybe you could consider joining our panel one day with all of your expertise and wisdom. And I see you have your hand up again. What's up? Or is that just a high five?
No, that was, so I kind of coming into the slate, are we talking like what's going to happen moving forward based on all the changes in the world, or, you know, because, you know, the history of money is incredibly interesting. And I'm a big fan of, you know, Ferguson from Harvard on basically the history of money.
Sure. So basically where we're at this point, this is the sixth episode in a little mini series that we've done since the new year. And we started with basically covering time preference in the first week, and then we went into what is the moneyness of an object and really what defines the money, and covering direct exchange, indirect exchange, from barter up through coincidence of need, scales, wants. And then we get into primitive monies, and then the historical monies and the rise and fall of empires, getting into the beginnings of paper money, and then essentially fiat money. So what we're basically covering tonight is what has happened since 1971 until present, and then we'll continue this into the future. Next week we're going to do an episode on the petrodollar and make sure that there's an understanding of really what the petrodollar is and exactly how it drives the current monetary system, and then we'll go from there. So topically tonight we are on, for lack of a clearer description, basically what the fuck has happened since 1971. And we're leaning heavily on the website WTF Happened Since 1971 as a resource, just because they have such poignant infographics that show all things across economic, political, socioeconomic scales that have essentially fallen off cliffs since 1971. So we're exploring basically the difference between causation and correlation, and just addressing all of the changes in the world that many people necessarily don't recognize all kind of coalesced around the same point in history.
So the 70s and 80s, having lived through them, I mean, they were crazy times, and they kind of feel like now. So we kind of talked about I brought up the issue of how inflation had this socio kind of economic implication. And I'll speak from the lower middle class, white, suburban, traditional space. Okay. I can talk to you about other places as well, but in that period of time, that was mostly my experience. I didn't get to Europe until I was 18, but you know, the other context in that period of time was the Cold War, right? So people believed we were, you know, somewhere between minutes and months away from, at any point in time in that period of time, with going toe-to-toe with the Ruskies, as they used to say, okay? And, you know, we had come off of, you know, my parents believed in 1962, I was a young kid at the time, that they were going to get nuked in minutes by the Cuban-Russian situation. That was kind of what their view was in the early 60s at that moment, or that weekend. So there was this whole buildup, and I'm educating myself to be an electrical engineer at this point in time. And just to give you a perspective, you know, you could read this in IEEE Spectrum from the period of time and or even today, 51% of all electrical engineers that were graduating from, you know, U.S. institutions with a bachelor's degree were going into the military industrial complex. Only 49% of them were going into commercial, you know, situations. By 1990, okay, it was on the order of 5 to 7.5% of electrical engineers were going into the military industrial complex. So that was a huge change in creativity, educational investment, whatever else. But that's the way the world worked. We were building bombs. We were not, you know, making a whole lot of butter in the 70s. So that affected many choices. And you guys are certainly familiar with what Nixon did and, you know, the implications the deal that Kissinger had to put together for the Eurodollar and the petrodollar to make that all work. But again, the context was we're going toe-to-toe. And there was this institution in Geneva, which I was at, called the GATT, the General Association of Trade, and I can't remember what it was, what the other T was, which was the predecessor to the WTO. And the GATT had been in operation for several decades. And its goal and role was to reduce and stop the import of technological goods from the West into the Soviet bloc. That was its role. It was the inverse of the WTO. What's fascinating is the WTO headquarters took over the GATT headquarters on Lake Geneva there in the suburb of Geneva. So anyway, just more context.
Love it. Yeah. Appreciate all the, or sharing with us, because, you know, there's a lot of new stuff for me. So love hearing about it and kind of perspective. So appreciate it.
No, well said, Marty. Man, that was awesome. I'd love to hear any more that you have to add on any of these other topics. Feel free just to cut in. Really enjoy the historical perspective, and you know, I mean, you give insight from someone that was there at the time, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and that goes broadly because we've got a really diverse community, lots of spanning ages, and you know, all sorts of types of other diversity. You know, sex, religion, everything. So feel free to, you know, if you have a question, raise a hand and see if we get a mic to you.
Yeah, someone born in the 80s is pretty cool to hear it firsthand and then engage. So thank you. We have 15 minutes left. I think we could go into one or two more charts. Maybe we could complete tweet five and do our final close and, you know, pick up where we left off. We got a ton of graphs here that trigger a lot of engaging conversation. So I think it's best that we'll pick this back up again next week and just continue to dive through these charts to drive conversation.
Dick, we're going to hit him with to be continued. Dick move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's keep it going here unless there's any other topics we want to cover with these last 15 minutes or so. Going once, going twice. All right, then. We are on tweet five, graph from the bottom left corner. So that is the income equality in the U.S. And I think this kind of ties into what you were talking about, Marty, and you could see that jump. What do you guys think? Let's keep it rolling.
Yeah, all of them. I think we kind of hit on this chart already, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows the sharp increase from the 1971, you know. So let's like kind of I think the next one kind of brings it together and really drives it home because it compares it to things that everyone is all familiar with, right? So if we go to the image in the bottom right corner of tweet five, we just see a little breakdown of, you know, 1971 cost of living. You know, I'll just rattle it out here. New house, $25,200. Average income, $10,622 per year. New car, $3,500. Average rent, $150. Harvard, speaking of university tuition, $2,600 a month. Movie ticket was $1.50. Gas, oh gosh, 40 cents per gallon. Postage stamp, 8 cents. Now we're on to food here. Granulated sugar, 62 cents per 5 pounds. Gallon of milk was $1.17. Ground coffee per pound was less than $1. Bacon was 80 cents per pound. Eggs were 45 cents per pound. Fresh ground hamburger, 62 cents per pound. Fresh baked bread, 25 cents per loaf. I wish we had comparables to where things are at now. But gas the other day was, in my area, was close to $5 a pop. So a long way away from 40 cents per gallon. It's just wild to see the dramatic effects here. Are there any particular things that you guys want to talk about in terms of particular items? And yeah.
Not so much me specifically. No, I'm good.
Well, the average new home price currently is 200 and let's see, it was 270,000 as of a year ago. And I know that my home alone has increased 90% since then in the last 12 months. So that's probably closer to a 20X since 1971 on a new home.
Yeah, I'm curious about what that Harvard tuition is now.
See, late.
Yeah.
Well, we have the technology. Harvard tuition is currently $54,000.
I'll start from the bottom of the list, and then maybe you guys could go from the top and see what Brett is looking like.
Well, in 72 and 79, you couldn't get gas. Okay. Because of the shortages that were kind of imposed politically. You know, I remember being with my dad, you know, on his motorcycle saying, hey, you know, it's an odd day. You can't get gas with your even license plate. And he's like, well, motorcycles are exempt from that. So that's how it worked. You couldn't get gas if you had an even plate, you know, on an odd day, because there was a real shortage of gasoline. And that might be something, again, you know, sorry, but a lot of this stuff that I remember from this period of time, the 70s and 80s, it really feels like it's coming our way now.
Yep. I mean, gas is at least a 10X since then. Average new car currently is $47,077. That's an 18X from the $3,500 that it was in 1971. I'm gonna go out on a limb and say here one of the things that's held up best since 1971 has been the United States postage stamp, because I think we're only at like a 5 or 6X on that.
I noticed that too.
Sell all your shit coins and buy forever stamps, people.
Noted.
I'm working my way up. I'm at bacon right now. I almost got them all.
Yeah, food. I don't think it's been as drastic as the living. But I think the next two or three charts do a good job of, you know, kind of putting it on a chart to represent. What's going on, Wonder Woman? How are you? Good to see you up here.
Hey, good to see you, Pepe. Yeah, I wanted to chime in that it's a little more peripheral, but still something that was changing drastically from the 50s to the 70s was the consolidation of family farms and smaller scale farms in the US. And so there was a drastic shift to these farms being sold off and there being greater like mechanization of farms. And so that also led to a shift in gender roles, to like requiring families to be both like dual income earners and working for someone else, not working for their own farm. Also, if anyone else has any other information on this, I'd be interested to know, but it also shifts food prices as well and consolidates, like when you were talking about the great increase in higher earners, you know, there's a less of a playing field amongst a wider number of farmers. And then there's a smaller number of like agribusiness CEOs making a huge amount of money. So that was all like from the 50s to 70s was also in play.
Yeah. And I think that ties into, I think on the next set of charts, the first thing that's food based is the Campbell condensed tomato soup, just to kind of show the influx in that, how that was a flat line at 10 cents from 1895 to 1970, looks like 1973-ish. And then since then has more than 12X to 10X. But later on in the charts too, what jumps out to me as far as just that we could do a whole nother episode on the corruption in like big farming, but the the bifurcation between chicken, big chicken, and the rest of the protein industries and farming industries. That's also covered a little bit later, where big chicken also got its kind of candle lit in 1971, roughly around 1971 as well, where it pulled away from the pack, and you get into the chicken mafias of the Tysons and Purdue's of the world and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, I take partial blame for that. I'm a big advocate for Dino Tyson nugs.
Chicken tendies and nuggies. Yeah, I called that graph just one word, meat, and that's it towards the end. We'll maybe get there next week. We're having a lot of fun with these graphs. But going back to the cost of living in 1971, I just pulled everything up. Just fun fact, you know, gallon of milk, $3.66 is what I'm reading. And what was it? What was it before? $1.17. Pound of ground coffee. And take these with a grain of salt. I'm just doing quick Googles here. $28.64. What are we on here? Bacon per pound, $7.21. Dozen eggs, $1.79. Cost per burger, a burger per pound, roughly around $4.50. And bread is, you know, depending on where you're at, around 90 cents. So big difference compared to what it was back in the day. On that note, I think we're good to close, because that means we will pick things back up.
Your mic's giving bad kickback. It's breaking up pretty bad.
If you have your phone plugged in, it might be power surge. That happens to me sometimes. I don't know if he's trying to talk.
I'm shooting messages in the Discord.
Yeah, it's just getting worse.
Well, if Pepe, do you want to start the wrap up? Final comments?
Yeah, I was just thinking the next charts are kind of getting into inflation. So, yeah, we can transition to that. Give me just a second to pull it back up. Flipping between the pictures and unmuting and muting my mic's killing me. So we'll move on to page 6, the top right picture, or graph, I should say. So it's the cumulative inflation, and if you look at starting in 1971, it's pretty absurd, the amount of inflation. It was sitting at a 306% in 1971, and up until 2015 on the graph, it's up to 2,300%. So, yeah, getting into inflation, it's pretty absurd when you look at it on the graph.
Yep, and that graph stops at 2015. Doesn't even include the latest ridiculousness. This graph you'd need a second monitor to get it all in one graph if you actually had this current through today. It's absurd.
Yeah, it's just like the relative flatness. I mean, from a little before 1915 to 1971, about a 300%, and since then it's just been straight up. But yeah, I agree. I wish we had the to 2022. That next leg would just be straight vertical up.
Well, I'm gonna put it this way: if you look, we doubled from 1920 to 1960. So over the course of 40 years, we doubled, right? We're currently on pace to double in every less than 7 years at the current rates. We're looking at doubling again in every like 5 to 7 years at current rates. So even if you extrapolated these numbers linearly and you figured that by 2020, we were at like maybe 2,600%, we are looking at being at 5,200% by 2026, 2027, and then doubling again. It's absolutely just insane. These numbers are beyond comprehension.
Yeah.
And this is where, like, I don't see how we just come back from this. I think that in terms of the reset that's discussed, not from like a conspiracy theory perspective, but that something's got to give, because there's no way to just Keynesianly explain these numbers away. This is absurd.
Yeah, I agree. It's just looking at it, just it's unsustainable. Just like one chart just can show it. But yeah, I mean, it's just an unsustainable trend. It's only getting worse. Just have to continue to print more to repay prior debts and keep fueling the endless money printer cycle. So it's, yeah, it's not good. Not good.
So the only way this Fed coupon train, it's already off the rails, but the only way that we can protect ourselves is to opt out. And that's why we're here educating and advocating sound money. And it isn't sustainable. And, you know, the Fed governors and or directors have kind of indicated, yeah, it's a faith-based system, right? It's literally just by decree, and it only has value because we have a shared social construct that the pieces of paper with dead presidents on them mean something and can be exchanged for goods or paying taxes, but they're not really worth anything other than the, you know, because our time is constantly being stolen from us, because what we're paid in our time for, if we don't opt out and convert them right away, continues to rob us of our time. And so we have to opt out. It's the only way that you can get any kind of time back. Otherwise, you're going to be a slave till your deathbed.
Absolutely. Gary and Powell are just going to keep on protecting us, huh?
Well, on that note, it is 10 o'clock. This is typically where we have a hard cut. And Floki's microphone is somewhere lost in the blockchain. So I think what we are going to do is, this is the first time we've this drastically run out of time. We still have probably at least half the content to cover. We're on 6 out of 22. So I think we have more than enough to fill a whole another week with this. And I think that we've got a captive enough audience that hopefully everybody can take a little time to watch the videos, especially that Floki posted in his first tweet, over the course of the next week, and come next week pretty prepared to participate. I think that the more we make this an open discussion to the entire audience, the better this content will be. But I think instead of trying to rush this content through, because it is so vital that people understand all these things and that we do discuss this to kind of, at least amongst ourselves, find consensus on what's caused and what's correlated. I think we should wrap here and we can repackage the remaining infographics for another round of this next week. I think this was fun, but I don't want to see us sell the rest of it short and try to rush through it, because I think that a lot of the meaty stuff, especially socioeconomically, falls at the end of these charts and things that are definitely ripe for discussion. And I'd like to see, hopefully, people bring some varying perspectives and people that come from different walks of life come and share their opinions on the matter as well, so that we're not just an echo chamber here. But with that being said, I think everybody should hopefully watch the videos that Floki tweeted, and Pepe, if you want to kind of take us around the horn just for closing thoughts, I think we pick this back up next week. I think this is a topic that is far too relevant for us to rush.
Yeah, no, and I totally agree. We love hearing from people, and we try to be as diverse and a well-rounded panel as possible. But yeah, obviously we need we want more perspective. Everybody has a different path to what led them here, so you know, all the input, we love hearing from the community, so I absolutely look forward to that. But yeah, I'll pass the mics around to everybody, do kind of a closing. I'll start with you, Frankie. It's been a little bit since we heard from you, so
yeah. Pepe, I know we've gone through a lot of graphs and statistics. I think I'll just leave, you know, one more statistic for you until next week. So M2 money supply, cash, coins, demand, and saving deposits doubled in the last 11 years. Well, from 2008, 35 trillion to 70 trillion in 2019. I would say in the last 2 years, that's probably increased another 20 trillion. So we're approaching that beautiful $100 trillion mark. So I don't know where the end in sight is, but you know, that's why we're in crypto.
No doubt. And appreciate you as always being up here and sharing current events. It's greatly appreciated and look forward to what you have next week. Aldo, how are you?
Yes, I'm doing great. I really enjoy these panels. I really enjoy doing the foreign affairs, and I can't wait till next week and just continuing with that and then continuing with the discussion today about the, you know, what WTF happened in 1971. I think it's an intriguing discussion, and it's really cool to see it graphically displayed. So I'm looking forward to the continuation of that. And I thank the panel, and I thank everyone that came out tonight to learn.
Love it, love it. And yeah, the kind of world news, it's super insightful, and you know, it's hard to keep up with everything. So appreciate you sharing every week. But Floki, I don't know if your mic's working any better.
Testing 1, 2, 3, do re mi fa sol la ti.
Yep. Yeah, loud and clear.
All right. Yeah, I had a good time pulling together the charts and putting a little fun Nixon point break narrative to it. I really recommend you guys check out the third tweet, which has, is it the third tweet or is it the second tweet? It is the second tweet. It is 2 of 22 that I list the three YouTube videos. I watched them today while walking the dog. I really recommend you watch them before coming to next week, maybe a couple days before, so you could just be ready to, you know, share your thoughts about what you think as we go through the graphs and we pick up on tweet 6. And strength and honor, everybody. This is one of my more favorite episodes.
Love it. And yeah, appreciate you putting that all together. I know that a lot of time went into that, and just something as simple as a Twitter thread can go a long way in, you know, helping the space. So appreciate that. Obi-Wan.
Yeah, I think I kind of gave some pretty good closing comments a minute ago, but yeah, if that doesn't motivate you to go buy some Bitcoin or some VGX or Luna, then I don't know. That's what I'll be doing.
Love it, love it. Michael?
As always, this has been fun. I enjoyed this one a lot. Thank you to Marty for popping up on the paddle and sharing your insight. I don't know if you're already VGX hero, but if you are not, I'm going to ask that maybe you come join our community. And the striking resemblance between your voice and Aldo's just makes me hope that you'll become the hero of Aldo's dad and at least be our mythical Aldo's dad in the VGX Heroes community. And in the spirit of Wonder Woman and Crypto Daddy Pig's running jokes of everything being the title of their junior high school bands and everything, I appreciate Wonder Woman coming up. 11 straight white males and Wonder Woman was the name of our junior high school recorder band. So I appreciate you coming up here and helping balance us out, Wonder Woman. We tried our best, but we came up awfully straight white male tonight.
Yeah, I appreciate you as well, Wonder Woman. You can give us a quick farewell.
Oh, sure, yeah. Michael, you can't help being a straight white male. It's okay. But I also really appreciate chatting up here. And in the spirit of what Michael said earlier, being able to analyze and look at things not with an immediate judgment of if it's left or right, but just looking at it in this entire like societal paradigm feels like a really important thing that we're doing in this space. So yeah, and this is an amazing space. Thank you to the whole education team.
Love it, love it. And Sun Tzu, get us out of here, my friend.
You guys ever, you know, like, do you remember what it felt like the first time, like, you got rugged?
No, I don't know. What are you talking about?
It's always funny how sometimes you can recreate that experience.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was VGX Heroes History of Money, Season 2, Episode 6, 1971 and Beyond. Recorded on Wednesday, March 9th, 2022.
This episode of the Ether was brought to you by Glow Yield. Glow Yield is the ecosystem of Terra decentralized apps like Lotto and Creators, all powered by DeFi Yields. Glow Creators helps artists and influencers give their fans exclusive perks through membership, NFTs, and more. Glow Lotto is a PrizeLink savings account with a weekly chance to win the big jackpot. Tickets are free and perpetual, which means there's zero chance to lose money. Be sure to follow Glow Yield on Twitter and join the Discord community to stay up to date with all the glowing projects and check them out online at glowyield.com. This episode of the Ether was also brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. This episode of the Ether was also brought to you by Orbital Command, a community validator on Terra dedicated to educating, expanding, and promoting the Lunatic community. Take advantage of their Terra Luna Intel report on Telegram, which brings you the hottest news and updates on all things Terra each and every day. Find it using the link in the show notes. You can also support their community efforts by considering them next time you're delegating or redelegating your Luna. Find out more at orbitalcommand.io. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening.
Mutation. It is the key to our evolution. It has enabled us to evolve from a single-celled organism into the dominant species on the planet. This process is slow, normally taking thousands and thousands of years. But every few hundred millennia, evolution leaps forward.
Diving through the forest, looking for the door to the portal. Said'll take me down a corridor. I'm ignoring the warning, storing importance. The core looks sourced from ancient coordinates. Smells like musty mutants, trust me. I've been hunting bugs since the leaves started rustling. I must be getting close, yo, the scene is disgusting. Parasitic mutations leeching off the country. Grab a couple samples and defy their custody. Feeding gamma rays to the beast at peak velocity. Mutating awesomely, pre-sato wanna me. Taking all the scraps and feed them to the lottery. Always evolving to defy the possibly. These are the things that will scream irresponsibly. Feeling uneasy, these genes get them off of me. I don't mean to trip, but am I mutating properly? We are the mutants. We are the mutants. We are the mutants. We are the mutants. Unlock the lab, it's time to do this. Breathing getting heavy, I can feel it in my arms, but I can't stop now.
Mutation.
It's an art form, don't be alarmed. If you see me looking odd when I'm out on the farm, spinning crop circles in your yard, reaching the stars, need a way to get across. Got this little
mutation,
lets me hack key cards. Scene looking like it came out the first three saws. Flexing like Rex when I mutate the precog. Leaders trying to research this genetic seesaw. Give me all the science and we'll leave you with the pre-slaw. Writers believe they bleed these endorsements, turning scientists into terror supporters. Gotta seize the spoils and release the spores. It's time to forage through DNA lore. So sink it or swim, silly Alice. Take the pill and see we're all mad here, taking over your facility. We are the mutants. We are the mutants. We are the mutants. We are the mutants. Unlock the lab, it's time to do this. We are the mutants. We are the mutants. We are the mutants. Unlock the lab, it's time to do this.
Terra Spaces.